Hi, I'm Sam Broadfoot QC.
And I'm David Locke QC.
And this is the third in a series of podcasts that we're recording to discuss the law around police pensions. And our huge thanks go to Amy Jansen, who has edited and produced this recording. Today we are going to look at the vexed issue of ill health retirements and ill health pensions. Future podcasts will look at the law around injury pensions, but today we are going to focus on the position of police officers who, for any reason, cannot continue with police service because of any form of disablement. As we have mentioned previously, the discussions in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. So, David, why are ill health retirements and ill health pensions such a key issue in the police service?
Well, Sam, policing is, as everyone knows, a stressful profession, and it can be a physically demanding job. And it's a sad but perhaps inevitable fact that a number of officers will respond to the physical and psychological stresses of the job by developing illnesses or injuries. The most obvious causes are assaults by suspects or prisoners, injuries when attempting to restrain subjects or prisoners, car accidents, and the inevitable injuries that arise in any workplace. In addition, policing is a psychologically stressful environment where results matter and officers are under pressure to perform. Some officers respond well to those stresses, but others develop mental health problems which can result in permanent illnesses. And the legal cases about disabled police officers each tell a tragic personal story. Officers have seen dismembered bodies and suffered the most unbelievable stresses or been subject to campaigns of harassment by the public and have developed post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or other serious psychological conditions. Further, policing has traditionally been a male, strong, hierarchical environment, which has on occasions not welcomed members who don't fit the traditional mould of white male police officers. And whilst a vast amount has been done in recent decades to improve the situation on diversity, but there are still some examples of officers from diverse backgrounds who are treated as outsiders and suffer stress as a result. For example, the recent case of PC Michael Iades, who was a white South African resettled in Scotland and joined the police force there. And when he moved to be a member of the Merseyside force, he was subject to entirely unacceptable behaviour by fellow officers who assumed, as it turned out entirely wrongly, that he fitted the stereotype of a South African man who was prejudiced against black people. And this harassment continued over a number of years, and he responded by developing very serious mental health problems and was eventually ill health retired because his mental health problems prevented him from being able to discharge his duties as a police officer. But there are other officers who develop cancer or other life-threatening conditions, who are involved in off-duty accidents on the road or when they're taking part in sporting events. And thus there are a vast number of different ways in which a formerly healthy, robust police officer can reach the position where he's medically unfit to continue in this demanding role.
That's right. There are three things that we need to bear in mind before looking at the way the medical retirement process works. First, not all health issues for police officers are related to the policing functions. As you mentioned, some police officers develop disabilities which have nothing to do with their work as a police officer. Second, even if a police officer is medically unfit to chase criminals, there are many roles in the modern day police service which are desk-based and which can be successfully carried out by officers who have some form of disability, and the provisions of the Equality Act 2010 in making reasonable adjustments for those with disabilities. Third, even if a police officer is required to retire from police service due to disablement, that does not automatically mean that he cannot undertake any other form of employment. In fact, many disabled police officers successfully transferred to civilian employment, which is compatible with their disabilities.
I agree with all those points. And as we shall see, the ill health retirement system in the police service is complex and nuanced, and it takes account of all of those issues.
So let's look at the decision-making process. What role do doctors play, and what role is played by the chief constable?
Decision-making under the police pension system is divided between some decisions which can only be taken by doctors and other decisions which can only be taken by the chief constable in her role as the Police Pensions Authority, or the PPA. One of the basic mistakes which is sometimes made is where doctors try to take decisions which can only be taken by the PPA, or the PPA tries to take a decision which can only lawfully be made by a doctor.
And there are two different types of doctor referred to, aren't there?
Yes, that's right. The doctor who makes the crucial decisions on the question as to whether an officer is permanently disabled or permanently medically unfit is called the selected medical practitioner, or the SMP. There are also doctors who work for police forces on a full or part-time basis, usually known as the Force Medical Advisor, or the FMA. The FMA works as part of the force staff, usually within an occupational health unit, which is called OCHI Health, or the OHU. The SMP is almost invariably a doctor who is instructed from outside the force. The SMP tends to be an independent occupational health doctor.
So who chooses the SMP?
The SMP is selected by the chief constable.
Ha, hence being known as the selected medical practitioner, or SMP.
Yes, that's right.
I see. Is the doctor's role to provide advice to the PPA, or is the doctor a decision maker in her own right?
Unlike doctors who work in the occupational health unit who provide advice to the force, once appointed, the SMP is a statutory decision maker. The chief constable appoints the SMP to make specified decisions on behalf of the force, notably as to whether a police officer is disabled or medically unfit, and whether that disablement or medical unfitness is likely to be permanent. But once the SMP makes that decision, it is binding on the chief constable and becomes in law a decision of the chief constable. Therefore, if the force doesn't consider the SMP has discharged her duties properly, the only way for the force to challenge the decision is for the force to seek a quashing of the SMP's decision by way of judicial review in the High Court. And in such a case, the chief constable is, in effect, going to court to challenge the decision of his own appointed doctor.
Right. So how does an officer actually get to see the SMP? In other words, what is the first step in the medical retirement process where an officer may be permanently disabled?
The first step is for the chief constable to refer the officer's case to an independent SMP. Now, in a High Court case called Yates, Mr. Justice Latham explained that in any case where an officer may be permanently disabled and sought a referral, the chief constable was under a statutory duty to make the referral unless the case was obviously spurious or vexatious.
Spurious or vexatious? Well, that suggests that the evidential bar is low and that a chief constable can't refuse to engage with the possible medical retirement process simply by refusing to appoint an SMP.
Yes, that's right. Police officers are entitled to 6 months on full pay when they're off work through illness and 6 months on half pay. Thus, an officer who is off for 12 months will often receive no pay, and that situation will almost inevitably give rise to questions as to whether the officer has become permanently disabled, and so will almost always require a referral to the SMP.
Are you saying that the norm, then, is to wait 12 months before the referral is made?
No. Some cases require 12 months, but in other cases, the question of a possible medical retirement is raised much earlier. As soon as it's raised, the chief constable has a statutory duty to refer the case to the SMP.
So what happens once the case is referred to the SMP?
Well, Home Office guidance suggests that the Force Occupational Health Unit doctor should prepare a report which explains the background for the SMP. The officer can also provide his own medical reports, and the SMP will usually read up the case in advance and then call the officer to an appointment where there'll be a discussion of the officer's health, and if appropriate, the SMP will conduct a physical examination.
Right. And once that has happened, what decisions is the SMP called upon to make?
Well, that depends in part on which set of police pension regulations applies to the officer. If the officer is a member of the 1987 or 2006 schemes, the first question for the SMP is whether the officer is disabled, as that term is defined in those regulations, and if so, whether the disablement is likely to be permanent. If the officer is a member of the 2015 scheme, the question for the SMP is whether the officer is medically unfit and whether that medical unfitness is likely to be permanent.
So what is meant by the terms disabled or medically unfit? Do they mean different things?
Not really. In practical terms, they mean the same thing, namely whether the officer is unable to perform all of the duties of a member of the police force as a result of any infirmity of mind or body. The term medically unfit seems more accurate than the term disabled, because the term disabled now has a very specific meaning under the Equality Act 2010 in relation to the discrimination against people who are disabled. But the definition of disability under the Equality Act 2010 is very different to the meaning of that term in the 1987 or 2006 regulations. Hence, a police officer may be disabled within the meaning of the police pension scheme, but not be disabled within the meaning of the Equality Act 2010. The reverse is also possibly true, but much more unlikely.
But the definition suggests that it is not just a case of an officer being healthy enough to discharge the police duties that the particular officer has to perform in his particular role. It sounds, from what you're saying, as if it's all of the duties of a police officer in the different types of roles that police officers have to perform. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That point was established in a case called Stewart and Sussex Police Authority.
Okay. So if the SNP thinks that a police officer is medically unfit in the way you've explained, the next question is permanence. The regulations suggest that this has to be looked at by reference to the date of the examination, and that the question is whether, on a balance of probabilities, any form of disablement is likely to persist on a permanent basis. Is that for the rest of the officer's life, or only until he would be compulsorily retired in any event, which I think is now age 60 for most police officers?
That issue was decided in a case called Scardfield, and it's now clear it's until the age of 60, not for the rest of the officer's life, however long it may be after the age of 60. Each set of regulations requires the SNP to produce a report which sets out the clinical findings made by the doctor and explains the answers to the statutory questions on medical unfitness and permanence. Once the SNP has produced his report, the findings are final unless the officer appeals or the chief constable seeks a judicial review, or both the officer and the chief constable agree that the issues need to be reconsidered.
Okay. And what happens if there are medical treatments which have not yet been tried and which might alleviate the officer's medical condition? Or if, perhaps more likely,
this is a slightly tricky area. The SNP can have a difficult task if the officer has not yet been offered normal, appropriate medical treatment for his disablement, or has been offered it and declined it. And the existence of normal medical treatment, which could alleviate the disabilities, cannot, of course, prevent the officer from being medically unfit at that point, but could affect the future position.
Because the question of disability is determined at the date of the examination.
Yes, that's right. So future medical treatment can't affect present disability, but it may affect the question as to whether the medical unfitness is likely to be permanent. If the treatment has been offered and refused, the SNP has to ask himself whether or not the officer's refusal is reasonable or not. And in a case called Metcalfe, the court decided this is a decision for the SNP, not the chief constable. In my view, that's plainly correct, even though the Home Office guidance appears to suggest, in my view incorrectly, that the reasonableness of the refusal is a matter for the chief constable. The SNP needs to decide whether the officer's refusal is reasonable, bearing in mind the advice that the officers had from the doctors who are treating the officer. Now, no one can be compelled to receive medical treatment, and if the treatment has potential adverse side effects, it may be entirely reasonable for the officer to say that he or she does not wish to undertake the risk. And the question is not whether the SNP recommends the treatment or not, but whether the officer's refusal is a reasonable decision or not. And that can be entirely dependent on the individual circumstances of the police officer.
I see. So what are the options for the officer if he disagrees with the SNP's decision?
The officer, but interestingly not the chief constable, has the right to appeal to the Police Medical Appeal Board, which is a board of doctors appointed by the Secretary of State to consider the same issues as the SNP, but to conduct an entirely afresh, new decision-making process. And the board will normally have one specialist member who's an expert in the particular medical area that's relevant to the case. So if the officer has a psychological condition, there'll be a consultant psychiatrist as a member of the board. And if the officer has a leg injury, the specialist member may well be a consultant orthopaedic surgeon.
As I understand it, where there is an appeal, the board must look at the issues afresh for themselves, addressing the same questions as the SNP, and they are required to produce their own report, which, as a matter of law, is substituted for the decision of the SNP. But what happens if there is a dispute between the force and the officer about the nature of his illness or medical condition or its causes?
Well, the SNP and the board are both quasi-judicial statutory decision makers. And where there's a dispute of fact, they'll need to consider the position put forward by both sides and then make findings of fact and then a clinical diagnosis prior to addressing the statutory questions of disablement and permanence. Once they do that, the essential clinical findings they've made are binding.
So it must follow, I suppose, that they need to give proper reasons for their decisions and can be overturned in law if they have failed to give them?
That's right. The giving of proper reasons is an essential part of any quasi-judicial decision. And the recent cases of, for example, Sharp versus the West Yorkshire Chief Constable and Fisher versus the Chief Constable of Northumbria, both turned on whether or not medical decision makers, that is the SNP or the PMAB, had given proper reasons. And in both cases, the courts quashed the decision of the medical authority because inadequate reasons were given by the person who made the decision.
Okay, so that's stage one. What happens next if the SNP makes a finding that the officer is permanently disabled or permanently unfit?
At this point, decision-making transfers from the SNP back to the Chief Constable. All police pension schemes give the Chief Constable a discretionary right to require a police officer to retire once the SNP has made a finding of permanent disablement or permanent medical unfitness.
But if it's a discretionary right, that must mean that the Chief Constable does not have to make a decision requiring the officer to retire.
That's right. There is some fairly detailed non-statutory guidance which explains the proper approach that Chief Constables are recommended to take in making the decision whether to require the officer to retire or not. And there is a strong emphasis on retaining disabled officers within the police service, if this is practicable, and doesn't expose them to additional risks.
And presumably forces are also under a duty to make reasonable adjustments for disabled police officers. And those adjustments could open up jobs which would not otherwise be available to officers with disabilities.
That's right. And there are lots of disabled officers who are working successfully within the police service. But we also need to be aware that there are jobs which are physically and psychologically demanding and could not be undertaken safely by somebody with a significant disability. Chief Constables must have regard not only to the interest of the police officer, but also to the interest of other officers and the interest of the public, albeit subject to reasonable adjustments.
Right, so to sum up then, once a police officer has been determined to be permanently disabled or permanently medically unfit, depending on which regulations apply, the Chief Constable has a discretionary decision whether or not to require him to medically retire. But can the officer take their own decision to retire and claim an ill health pension?
Not under the 2006 or 2015 schemes. An ill health pension is only payable to someone under those schemes who has been required to retire by the Chief Constable. The position under the 1987 scheme is much less clear, and I deal with this in the chapter which we're publishing alongside this podcast. But in summary, the answer appears to be that an officer can make his own decision under the 1987 scheme. And there's a case called Sharp versus Chief Constable of West Yorkshire, which supports that argument. But the position is not free from legal ambiguity.
If the officer is required to retire, when does he acquire the right to an ill health pension?
Ill health pensions are payable from the date of retirement for the rest of the life of an officer.
Unless he's offered the chance to come back into the police force later?
Yes, that's right. There are provisions in each of the police pensions regulations which allow the question of disablement to be reconsidered at a later date. The medical diagnosis involves an element of prediction, and some predictions will be right, some will be wrong. And so some medically retired officers may recover to an extent that allows them to carry on being police officers. In other words, their disability has ceased. And if the SMP is called upon to make an assessment and reaches the decision that the officer is no longer disabled, the SMP produces a report to that effect, and the Chief Constable then has a choice. She can either agree to carrying on paying an ill health pension, or she can offer to reinstate the officer as a member of the force at the same rank as he was before he was medically retired. And if an ill health pension is offered reinstatement, the ill health pension stops after 3 months, regardless of whether the officer accepts the offer to rejoin the service or not. However, if the ill health pensioner was a member of the 1987 or 2006 scheme, and it was more than 5 years since he retired, there are some really difficult issues about whether he is entitled to rejoin the original pension scheme of which he was an active member, or whether he's required to rejoin the 2015 scheme. The 2015 regulations say that he should be readmitted as a member of the new, that is 2015 scheme, but those provisions may well be another example of age discrimination, and therefore chief constables might have to readmit such a person to being an active member of the original pension scheme. If that situation applies to an officer, he or she should seek specialist legal advice.
David, thank you very much for explaining this so clearly. As you mentioned, there is an accompanying chapter of the guide with more detail. This is available free of charge at www.landmarkchambers.co.uk. David and I will be back in episode 4 on police injury pensions. We hope you will join us then, and thank you for listening.